All right, I'm Alden Bryant, and I'm here to present some material tonight, and I'm speaking to our two good friends with a camera, and whomever else will be picking up on this in the future. My own background, I'm here to talk about environment and what's happening with the climate and energy, and then start this way. I spent most of my life in California and elsewhere. My degrees were here at Cal and Berkeley in mechanical engineering and economics. And I've worked for public utilities. I've worked for Bechtel in building a cost engineer on the Pittsburgh power plant here in Pittsburgh, California. In the 70s, I got involved in the solar energy. And I was on the board of directors of the two solar groups, Northern California Solar Energy Association and the California Solar Industries Association. I was liaison between the two groups. I was very concerned with solar in all of its smaller applications, but particularly solar electric power plants to replace nuclear. And we almost had one going. It was put forward by a design by Professor Otto Smith of Berkeley and the Wismer Becker Engineering Group up at Sacramento. And the State Department of Water Resources wanted to build it on their land to pump water from Southern California to the north. But that design for solar electric power was totally stopped by the nuclear people back in Washington, and especially when they talked to President Jimmy Carter out of doing anything in that direction once he was elected. Although we had a lot of our material in his campaign, which his group agreed to back during the campaign. So part of my role has been as president of the Earth Regeneration Society, and that was formed in about 1983, on April 22nd, 1983. Happened to be Earth Day. Coincidence. We came together following an interview on a local radio station here, KPFA, which is one of the most outstanding public stations in the country. And that's in Berkeley. We had a one-hour interview there, following which about 26 people came together in many disciplines, and our main goal was to say, what is physically happening around the climate change? So just to give a little background on that, our finding was three of the main scientists in the field say, we are at the end of the interglacial period, around 10,000 years, and we're at the end. We're moving into more glacial conditions. The soil minerals are badly depleted after 10,000 years of rain. The forests are dying. This is happening very much in the Germany and Europe, as well as around the U.S. And they were bringing them back to life, where they put more minerals back in the soil, good rock dust mineral that helped them come back to life. This was done under the Academy of Science in Austria, with two of the scientists there, one of whom was on our board of advisors with the Earth Regeneration Society. So we're dealing with soil, with what happens with forests, and then with the carbon dioxide increase, and what we've been hearing about now for 20, 25 years, is the increase in carbon dioxide as you burn fossil fuels and as part of the forests that are dying. And here it means far more heat around the equator, holding that heat, and more evaporation. And in the mid-80s, very logical, satellites began saying, we're seeing rivers of moisture going from the equatorial areas up to the Antarctic into Greenland, the high area in the center of Greenland. So we found at that time that there was 4 to 5 feet a year of ice increase in the Antarctic and in the center of Greenland. By photograph information and by information of people who are in these areas. So this is the what is happening from the equator up. But then, when you're having more and more ice in these areas, you're having far greater freezing coming down. And we remember the newspapers in the late 1980s. You could see 10, 15, 20 cities listed in the even the San Francisco Chronicle, all-time record cold temperatures in the winter. In the summer, you're having greater and greater heat. Therefore, from our group, one of the things we did was design and develop a bill for the U.S. Congress on Earth Regeneration and Climate Stabilization in 1992. I did a good part of the writing of that bill, and our Congressman, Ronald V. Dellums, put that in the Congress. And it had a normal course. It went to about 8 different committees, and it rested quietly there. And with the pressure from the oil industry, it never came out of committees. So that's just part of our history. But we tried. We made every effort we could. Our work and our publications on the climate cycle, what is beginning to happen, and what we expect in the future in the way of far greater hurricanes, where the hot and cold air masses are hitting more and more in the temperate zones in the world. The greater, the reef, the deforestation will be leading to the dry desert areas and the greater, far greater fires. All of this we were laying out in 1983. In the beginning of our campaign, we're going to see far greater hurricanes, tornadoes, flooding, dry areas, and killing crops, and the fire situation. I guess not many people were aware in the United States the greatest fires ever recorded, to my knowledge, were in northern China and in the Soviet Union. Tremendous fires back there. I think it was around the early 1900s or late 1980s. Long time and tremendous fire in those areas, the greatest the world had ever come across. Of course, now we have a tremendously serious thing going on right now, Southern California in many places. Well, we've often spoken about that in public or among ourselves, that the oil industry, well, put it this way. Back when we first were coming out with our literature and our proposals and trying to relate to organizations here and in other countries, from the Earth Regeneration Society, the oil industries, the international group, a number of those top people met on the east coast of the U.S. I'm told this by a Navy scientist who knew some of these people who met. They had a special meeting and said, we don't want to hear anything about the end of a glacial period and glacial, interglacial activity, and therefore we're going to start and just say warming. We know that CO2 causes warming. It might do some things and melt the poles a little, raise the oceans a little in the future, but way off. And then what happened was maybe 100 different people were involved in discussing warming in different ways, and the public was totally confused and inactive, and there was almost no threat to the profits of the oil industry. Well, now, one example of that is that we're getting into Adam Trombley's material, and Adam Trombley is one of the main people of 4 or 5 here and in India and a couple of other countries, developing new energy, new physics, which would be a replacement for oil and nuclear. And that's what we're going to end up with here when we develop his material and tell what he and the others have done. Out of the old Tesla Society, and a lot of people remember Niagara Falls, the KGO video on Niagara Falls and its history, its geological history. And then the Tesla came over from Europe and had his goal in life to harness some of that energy for electric use. He developed the alternating current, which became the basis for electric industry in this country and worldwide. That was Tesla. But Tesla went on to a far greater understanding of the nature of the forces in the world, what we observe and what we've dealt with before in engineering and physics, but the role of the space around us and the tremendous area of energy from space. That is what he and the group developed following the electric current development from the Niagara Falls. So a lot of what Tesla did from the 20s on up into 1943, when he was going to take information about the new energy, the new forms, and talk to President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The meeting was set up, but it never happened. He died of a mysterious situation and was not able to go to that meeting and not open up the new energy in that sense. Years later, will they even find that in this material tonight? He was poisoned. One of the detectives handling the case at that time came forward way later in life, say he saw the coroner's report poisoning for the death of Tesla. So this is the extent of which major industry is going to stop any really serious change in what they're doing. So I'd like to introduce myself in a different way. After the work in the solar efforts in the 70s, in which, by the way, that's some design, Otto Smith's design for solar electric power, was one of the best in the world at that in 1972. In 1977, I'd been asked to go to the Soviet Union and be a presenter in the 6th World Electrotechnical Congress. I was asked to come and give an overview paper on solar energy for the whole United States, solar electric power. So I gave a paper developed around that theme. I was maybe, I think, the third presenter of the entire conference, about 3,000 people there. Well, we met with, a few years later, they had a meeting with solar people in the Soviet Union and asked me to sit in, about 25 people. And they described, in the course of this is a humorous point, they described that in their country, it was fairly open and sort of an open discussion of their major problems. And the biggest thing that was under discussion with science people was what to do with their oil supplies, how fast should they use them, how fast should they sell them to other countries. And as for the solar people, these, our friends said, we were very small. We're down in Tashkent. We didn't have much money. Nobody paid any attention to us. I said, that's all right. It's the same in the United States. Well, they thought a minute, and they thought they understood a little bit, but they don't know too much about the U.S. They never did, most of them. Now, Otto Smith, I'm very glad to mention, Professor Otto J.M. Smith, professor of electrical engineering, computer science, professor here at Cal, now retired. He did such fine work in his field that in the Soviet Union, they had a book over an inch thick on electrical information of his. And so it's his volume of electrical engineering training. So that our joke was, every time Otto went to the Soviet Union, he had lots of money in the bank, could travel where he wants, but he can never take that out of their country. Anyway, now we go ahead with the whole question of what we're going to develop around climate. Now, my personal role in this was as president of Earth Regeneration Society. I was something on an organizing end. One of the main scientists in this was Dr. Fred Bernard Wood, who designed computers for IBM for 27 years before he retired. And a number of other scientists who helped get this going at the start. Professor Kenneth Watt of UC Davis in environmental studies. So what happened was we put forward a program around soil and forest and energy. And this resulted finally in a meeting in the United Nations in New York in December of 88. And that was sponsored by a member of the United Nations, which was the ambassador of Malta, Alexander Borg Olivier. There was another party that was very active with the UN efforts and cooperation who helped put it all together. Thirdly, I was involved in it as president of ERS, our Earth Regeneration Society. And basically, I chose the main speakers for that day, a full-day conference, and I anchored it at the end. Our understanding was that our friend Alexander Borg Olivier, he had Let's go back a step. There was a very big conference in the World Trade Center, of all places, June of 1988, and that was the International Association of Scientific Workers, most of them from Europe. And they decided to meet in U.S. that year. And I had a paper for that conference. I'd been alerted to it and had organized a special science group as a workshop panel during the conference. Our friend from the Soviet Union, the plane was late, and I ended up giving the opening address with my paper on climate stabilization. And following that meeting, following the conference, we went to the United Nations Environment Program, UNEP. It's my home away from home, and Dr. Noel Brown was the New York head of UNEP in those days. And I addressed a package to every member of the UN, which was delivered. Malta and Alexander Borg Livier picked up on that more than any other country. He put a resolution, a statement into the UN that stabilizing climate is a human right and a human goal. And that was passed early in December without a dissenting vote. And it's just a question of understanding. He and I sat on a sofa out in the hall a little later that day, and he says, "Alden, why did the U.S. delegate to the UN try so hard to keep me from putting in that resolution?" And I just looked and I said, "The oil industry?" And he says, "Yes, I know." I mean, that's why they were on him very hard to not put that resolution in. But they didn't want to vote against it when the entire General Assembly passed that without a dissenting vote. Later that week was our all-day conference, December 9th. And following that conference, Borg Livier put the two resolutions in the UN that set up the Rio Summit, and we got the Climate Treaty. And 10 years later was the meeting down in Johannesburg. And I sent down a two-page statement with various friends there to the Johannesburg meeting, urging that they put a request into the UN General Assembly to start a 15-year crash program on new forests, rebuilding forests, based on the history of each country, and new technology so that no more CO2 would be emitted. And that a 15-year crash program developing forests would go as far as possible on a full path of bringing that CO2 level back to the conditions we knew in the middle of the 1900s. Namely, from now 372 or more parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere back down to about 280 as around 1900. That's what we knew, and that's what we would try to do with forests and new energy. And how do you go at something like this? We turn to a very good friend, Professor Paul Zinke, a national figure in the U.S. and a senior professor here at Cal, now retired. And he says, take as your rule of thumb the average growth rate, net growth rate of forests. Some are dying, some is growing. He says, around the equator, think of 15 cubic meters of wood per year per hectare. 15. Go up to the middle, the temperate zones, our pine forests. Think in terms mostly of 10 cubic meters of wood per hectare per year. Now go up to, Finland and way in the north. What do you get up there? So he liked to ask people, make a hazard a guess. Remember, it's cold, it's rocky, there's very little nutrients, so maybe 2. But he says, use a figure of 10 in your international estimates to show the picture. Well, that's where a lot of our work came from, somebody like that. So there is our approach to what we call the full path of stabilizing climate, to bring the CO2 level back to around 280 parts per million. Now, getting past this little part of it, let me point out, you had to put this bill in Congress. We did that. And as I mentioned, Congressman Ron Dellums, whom I'd known since before, we worked the anti-poverty program in San Francisco at one time, before he ran for the city council in Berkeley. So we've been friends ever since, and close associates. So he's the one that put that bill into Congress, and in 1992 and again in 93. And when the Rio summit was held, President Bush, the first Bush, went to that. And one reason he went was that Dellums sent him a one-page blistering letter on the need for the president to be down there to give some word of support to that effort. Well, many people may have corresponded with President Bush, but that was one tremendous letter. All right, now, when we get to the question of energy, we get to Adam Trombley, and we have a paper from that's a talk he gave to a conference in 1988 in Colorado Springs. A very fine summary of environment, what is happening in the environment, and what is going on in the energy from the time of Tesla and even before, when the first equations were known around 1900. Full equations, there were two parts of which they were not used at all in this country and had to be in the last 10 or 15 years. The Soviet Union developed this 50 years ago, called scalar electromagnetics, which you can knock a plane down from a distance. And it's torn apart, and you never know what happened, unless you understand. Such as Tom Bearden in this country and other people that know who have been in the intelligence area and know what this kind of technology is. Well, now we can go. Whenever the question of energy, new energy forms from space, energy from space, or this, it's referred to in a number of ways, and there may be hundreds of certain different technologies moving in this. Well, most people that are not familiar with this, and even scientists who are very familiar with the, physics laws of energy and such, they say this can't exist. It doesn't. It can't be. We don't know about it. So there's a lot of resistance. Not only that, but of course the resistance from, let's say, oil and nuclear people that want to run their business and don't want any major new development coming in. So I was about to explain myself in this sense. Being fully involved in climate stabilization efforts in many directions since 1980. Since that wonderful interview for an hour by Catherine Webb on KPFA, she interviewed me from 12 to 1, and that's where a lot of this started. But before that, we had correspondence from Don Weaver, John Hammaker, people who were really moving in this area and exploring it. So anyhow, what I'm saying is that I'm open to all religious groups, all political parties, all species, human and other, because if we go all the way through the way we're going now, we will not have enough oxygen for any of us to be alive on this planet. And as Trombley points out, 10 or 20 years from now, the full cycle will may have gone through. If we don't change anything, go on as we are, we'll all be deceased from lack of oxygen. So that's just as a summary to start with. That's based on what you'll see here, from cutting the forests so seriously as in Ethiopia, other parts of Africa and South America, and even elsewhere. Then the hydraulic cycle. What happens with rain? If you don't have the forest, you don't have a rain cycle anymore. You're getting terrible drought, as in Ethiopia. The clouds that do not have much rain in them. The river watersheds are drying and dying. Tremendous dust clouds are developing that NASA films have shown, and dust clouds going from Africa clear across to the Caribbean every year. And I know people who have been up in Switzerland and said, look out their window up there in the Alps area. What's this brown dust on the snow and glaciers in Switzerland? Blowing up from Africa, the same situation. And then the fires, tremendous forest fires. And of course, now we have a combination of the forests, the tinder areas, as in Southern California, the dry air, the hot temperatures, the dry winds, the whole thing. We were forecasting that and writing that up as best we could starting in 1983. totally bypassed, and our, let's say, our friends in the oil industry decided not to allow any reference to the full climate change, just warming, nothing about the freezing coming down and the warming coming up and the direct and terrible interactions. Just talk warming a little, but nothing else. Professor Kenneth Watt had two of his students who had progressed come back from working in the energy department, the federal government. They said the political pressure is such you can't mention the word interglacial. Nothing past just warming. So here we're looking at constant misinformation around this word warming. It's just to kind of deaden and confuse the American and international public. And a few science people who are heavily part of or influenced by the oil industry came out with just this warming and look at this and set up the computer models. And this went on ad infinitum with no recognition of the full system. So here people have been suffering more and more. Now, Lester Brown in this country with an institute of his, he could not move on this in 1985 when I gave him literature on the full climate change at a World's Future meeting in Washington, D.C. He would have lost all of his support. But years later, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, two of his staff put out a fine report summarizing the financial loss due to the climate change. Around 1980, maybe $1 or $2 billion of direct financial loss. 20 years later, about nearly $100 billion. And they put this out in a 4-page summary, of which we have a copy, and we're in touch with them personally. And now look how fast that acceleration is going on and how far more extreme all of this. But in our response to this fine work on this financial loss picture, it was in the Chronicle even, this chart. Our response was, what happens to the people who lost their home, lost a factory or a place to work, lost their farms, lost the schools and roads or hospitals? What happened in their lives after this? That too is a terrible loss. It couldn't be in these kinds of the figures they were able to put together. Now, let's think about Adam Trombley. And here is a kind of structure just to keep in mind, and it's okay in a presentation to give a little summary. So think forests, they're cut. Deforestation. Think of what happens to the rain cycles. Think of what's happened in clouds with far less rain if there's no forests under them. Watersheds along great rivers in the world have been drying and receding. The dust clouds that are moving out in such a very large magnitude. The fires that have been occurring in the forests in different parts of the world. And then what's hitting the U.S. more and more. Then think of silt in the rivers and in the bays, building up from areas where there's no forest anymore. The CO2 buildup, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and the other gases that are moving up very high into the atmosphere. And where you get up to around 70,000 feet, you're going to cut back on the ozone up there. And where you have a great, you know, expensive break in the ozone, you have that ultraviolet coming through and burning people and crops. And, maybe a lot of us have heard down Australia, the ozone is so bad, the ultraviolet is so bad, they were giving scores in the newspaper every day. This was starting years ago, 5, 6 or more years ago. It's very heavy. Kids don't go to school that day. And that was part of the picture down there. But now here's what Trombley pointed out, that the ozone, where you're talking about maybe 70,000 feet up or even coming from lower down, about 7%, well, about 2, 3, 4, 6, 7%, there are different figures on the amount of decrease in the world's ozone. He points out that over the Antarctic back in 1987, it was about a 96% depletion. And a special science group went in with nylon jumpsuits, and they were badly degraded from that UV. It hit them so hard. And a number of them had very serious effects on their eyesight, regardless of goggles. So this is what was happening down there. But looking at the world, if you're seeing something like 6 or 7% depletion in the ozone already, and he points out that maybe, and you'll see in the paper, maybe 7% more, you're going to have ultraviolet not only knocking out all kinds of crops in agriculture, but the phytoplankton in the ocean, which is the basis, the food chain for the ocean's food, and the source of oxygen for the world. Half of it roughly comes from the phytoplankton, half from the forests. That's the general approach to the situation. We're destroying the forest and moving to destroy the phytoplankton. What do you got left? Well, that's kind of the conclusion of his paper. So that introduction, I would just like to read to you what he delivered. And he says, this was 1988, Adam Trombley, Colorado Springs, a conference. He says, as this is the last speech of the conference here, I'm going to give it an overview of the development of zero-point theory, and I'm going to try and take into account all of you and how you have been very patient. The basic principle, which we are obviously here to address, was originally elaborated by Nikola Tesla. The sense that Nikola Tesla conveyed of existence was, if not unique, then certainly it was profoundly inspired, not so much by initial analysis, but by initial vision. We have become a rather left-brain biased society, an analytically biased society. And as a result of this analytical bias, we tend to refute or deny the validity of intuitive jumps or intuitive leaps and insight. Tesla was an extraordinarily prolific inventor, obviously. But in addition to being a prolific inventor, he explored very thoroughly, for his time, the dimension of the psyche. And I think that perhaps too often, we tend to forget that he himself claimed that the source of his inspiration was not conventional. He saw what he built, and then he described it to a draftsman and built it. The draftsman was his interface with substance. To consider that when he was riding his carriage or his Pierce Arrow here in Colorado Springs, not far from where we are right now, he would often see devices in their totality, spontaneously. It's quite remarkable. When you see something in its totality, it tends to have a different meaning than if you tried just to put pieces together of the universe, putting it back together to arrive at a conclusion. Tesla insisted that he rested in the conclusion in his own psyche. I think this is very important. Tesla was not an analytical apologist. He was not somebody who made gestures to the scientific community to make himself necessarily acceptable in his time. What was acceptable was that he produced. The means by which he produced were often unacceptable, especially in the last couple of decades. Therefore, we heard a lot about Thomas Edison. We heard a lot in our education about just about everybody else except Nikola Tesla. The reason I'm sure this society exists is this left a vacuum, a huge vacuum that is not merely filled by the acknowledgement of Nikola Tesla, but by the acknowledgement of the function of a human being, the function of a being not being polarized to the left hemisphere, but balanced to the two hemispheres of the brain. In other words, vision coupled with analysis. And the develop of our generator, speaking here of Adam Trombley, which we originally called the acyclic closed magnetic generator. Vision was implicitly necessary to arrive at our conclusions. Basically, we had to work from very little information. There were very few explorers in the field, and we had to begin to consider that perhaps the way we considered reality actually fundamentally incorrect. That fundamental cornerstones, such as the law of induction, for example, that particular cornerstone was not necessarily as we believed it to be. What stimulated me, and I've said this before, since 1980, was the recognition that certain astrophysical phenomena express energies in excess of what the apparent input is. Now stop there for a minute. He and his partner developed a demonstration that showed 40 watts coming in and 50 kilowatts going out. That's a ratio of 50,000 to 40. He was going to demonstrate this to over 30 members of Congress. And those, when first Bush was president at that time, he in effect became an extreme. He stopped those members of Congress going to that demonstration. He found reasons why they had to stay in Congress. This I hear from members of the Tesla Society and also people in the Democratic Party that are aware of a lot of this. So they never got to that. But that laboratory, some days later, marshals let a group come in there and totally destroy that laboratory, $20 million lab, and the demonstration model. And they gave Tesla a document, something like an R-37 in those days, saying this is a secret decided here by the federal government. You cannot work on it or create one or even talk about it. He was totally suppressed. And he and his partner had all of their materials destroyed at that time. So that was the extremes that they were facing. But now here in 1988, when he was talking about their work, he says, what stimulated me, I've said this before, since 1980, was the recognition that certain astrophysical phenomena express energies in excess of what the apparent input is. This is a very common thing in astrophysics, whether you're talking about quasi-stellar objects or whether you're talking about the planet Jupiter. He says, when we first found out that the planet Jupiter was developing a looped current between itself and the moon, Io, Jupiter was called, in a paper published by the Goddard scientist at NASA, a homopolar generator. Well, this is part of developing the language of the new physics. They tried to rationalize that the relative motion between the moon, Io, and Jupiter was actually responsible for the current that we could measure by virtue of its magnetic flux tube as tested by satellite probe. But when you went through some very simple calculations, you found that was not true. So we decided that we would look into the matter of homopolar generation itself, the history. Who came up with it? As Bruce De Palma, keep him in mind, and others have pointed out, even though Michael Faraday did an experiment in December of 1831, in which he co-rotated a magnet with a copper disc, a Cooper disc, and measured a current output, even though he had done that experiment, his own law of induction tended to ignore that fact. A professor with the Royal Society in London, a professor of science history, told me that the original Faraday cage was designed to keep electromagnetic noise out, but to keep Michael's understanding in. You see, he played with a substance we call mercury. In those days, there was very little appreciation of the toxicity of mercury. And so Faraday apparently suffered from a form of dementia, which we've heard very little about, because it's one of the cornerstones of the building we've been living in science. We found out after we found Faraday's diary, after we found the citations and the experiments that he had done, that there was a gentleman by the name of Bruce De Palma in Santa Barbara, California, who had suggested that on the basis of the co-rotation of a magnet and a conductor, which we were at that time contemplating ourselves, it might be possible to generate more energy out from the generator than input in. I must say that my initial response to that was probably not as skeptical as some people might be when they heard such a thing. Because in the field of astronomy and astrophysics, it's not uncommon at all to find an object that is obviously exceeding what we, quote, know to be its thermonuclear or any other form. It's exceeding that output that it could possibly have by thermonuclear means, by fusion, by fission, or anything we normally consider. Buckminster Fuller, a lot of you remember his name, was a huge influence in my life. I met him when I was 16 years old, and largely because of his influence, I wasn't permanently lost in space, lost in the theoretical level of things. And therefore, when I began to encounter this resistance, he said something was very important to me. He said that every new idea, every new technology, every major breakthrough has an inevitable period of gestation. He said you must learn to be patient. He had experienced profound resistance, as you may know, to various ideas that he had in the 30s. I think that what we are really seeing is not the resistance or inertia imposed upon this technology, but instead a resistance to a fundamental shift in perception about the universe itself. Perception about the universe itself. We've tended to describe ourselves in discrete terms as encapsulated beings with rather defined boundary layers, both temporally and spatially. We're born, we die. The boundaries of our bodies are the boundaries of our being. Inspiration has a difficult time entering into a closed bottle. Where would it come from? Where would it appear? Now, could Nikola Tesla say he got ideas from space? He was considered a very eccentric and crazy man as a result of his statements. People point out that he always had all of these napkins piled up next to his plate, but by the end of his life, people had forgotten that his vision is what is powering these lights. And if we had continued with his vision, we wouldn't have a fossil fuel economy today. Now, there's a key thing in this entire presentation. We wouldn't have a fossil fuel economy today. And J.P. Morgan and Rockefeller and a number of other individuals would not have amassed extraordinary fortunes on the basis of that fossil fuel economy. I think this is extremely important for us to understand, because when Nikola Tesla's vision was denied, a part of our own vision was denied. Just as when Galileo's vision was denied. By the way, there's a tremendous presentation on Galileo's life on television a week or so ago. The fact of the matter is that as we sit or stand here, a field of energy pervades us. Even relatively conventional physicists like John Archibald Wheeler stated in a 1962 article in the Review of Modern Physics, energy has a mass equivalence of 10 to 94th power grams per centimeter. 10 to the 94th power. You multiply 10 94 times, you have an astronomical figure. But this is talking about in terms of grams per cubic centimeter. So go on. You just need to look in the literature. That 94th power grams per cubic centimeter represents a rather coherent statement. It represents something we could very easily call a continuum. But because of the taboo against the idea that you might perhaps be able to get water from the well of space, or what people call perpetual motion, there has not been a sense of any kind of practical application. Once in a seminar, well over a decade ago, I asked a question I found was extraordinarily taboo, and I said, "Why can't we tap into this field?" Fred Bernard Wood asked a similar question when he was a student getting his PhD in electrical engineering here at Cal. He asked Professor why the two main elements at the end of these early equations were never utilized. He was told, "They have no meaning, we don't use them." They had never been developed here, but the Soviet Union did develop them 50 years ago, somewhat in the Tesla approach. It has been established in the literature in Europe by Philip Cipollone. Since 1951-1952, that not only did the fluctuation field exist, a fluctuation field of extraordinary energy equivalence, and that the vacuum field was biasable, that it was polarizable. The polarizability of a vacuum, fluctuation background, I believe is the essential issue, and a very simple issue indeed, that we need to really consider. David Deutsch, in 1982, explored briefly in a book called General Relativity on Einstein's Centenary, which was edited by Hawking, considered very briefly the fact that not only is the vacuum polarizable in terms of density, but that an ideal theoretical situation density polarization could asymmetrically approach infinite density and asymmetrically approach negative energy density. That means that within the vacuum fluctuation itself, stress can be created. That means that the vortical dynamic that Tiwari speaks of, Tiwari, by the way, the man who was very instrumental in developing nuclear energy in India, and then moved on to this energy from space, and is a designer of this similar technologies now in India. That means that the vortical dynamic that Tiwari speaks of is really not that difficult to imagine, because you have fluctuation density that wishes to remain isotropic or uniformly distributed, disrupted, polarized, in a curved manifold. That vacuum density, once polarized, wants to relax from that stress back into a more isotropic state. And some people listening to this get the general idea, even if they don't understand half of the words in that paragraph. And a lot of these I couldn't define myself. But I'm with this, and I'm with this in the sense of its meaning in our lives, and the need for new energy, and the climate stabilization, and the continuing the environment of our world. Anybody who studies vortical physics, fluid dynamics, plasma dynamics, knows that there is no greater stress than that by which we invoke a vortical momentum. And therefore it is not hard to imagine, if we simply consider the fact that we're dealing with a medium of this extraordinary density, it is not hard to imagine or even begin to feel that just by simple biasing this field in a rotating cylinder, or perhaps in an oscillating circuit, by biasing this field correctly, we can precipitate vortical momentum. And here I'm referring to his model that had that 40 watts coming in and 50 kilowatts going out. He is living and working and producing within this kind of discussion and this kind of understanding. Now we may only precipitate a quasi-electron in the vacuum fluctuation of space. Their production is occurring all the time. In a biased environment, however, where an electrical potential exists, that quasi-electron, instead of annihilating with its antiparticle, might indeed be distracted along the potential and find its way into what we refer to blithely as manifestation. It doesn't necessarily take tremendous electron volts for this to occur. And that's why Terawi and Bruce De Palma, myself and others, speak of the generation of power from space. So there are some of the simple words coming from all of this kind of discussion and this work. He says, we need to very simply and seriously consider that it's already in the literature. It isn't just in the literature of the fringe. It's in the literature now, even of Physical Review, since 1975. Review of Modern Physics, since 1962. And in European literature, since the 1950s. It's a remarkable thing that because of the bias against so-called, in quotes, perpetual motion, so-called, quote, free energy, that nobody seems to want to extrapolate what is implicitly obvious. The atom itself can then be seen as a dynamic modification of field space. Only a dynamic modification of field space with no quality of stasis whatsoever. He goes on, Harold Puthoff in 1987, an article in Physical Review, pointed out that in order for the hydrogen atom in its ground state not to collapse, it had to be absorbing energy from fluctuation background. In this moment, this is not something that happened at t equals zero before the Big Bang. This is something happening at this moment. Real time, pardon, real time, present context, now with every atom and every molecule that we see configured about before us, is happening right now. It is wonderful to have Dr. Puthoff describe this energy in terms of the Bohr, B-O-H-R, atom. It is implicit that the electron orbit dissipates energy. If we consider that to be a resonant shell with no locatable density bias, then it still pertains because the atom itself, even in its ground state, resonates in space. We have a picture that we got when we were young that says a thing is solid, even though particle physicists are telling us nothing is solid, and while that's all fascinating on Nova television, we still have a picture that persists. Can an atom, existing in certain states of polarization and stress, perhaps become a conduit drawing upon the energy of space, a transducer in a certain light? Obviously, it must be, or else it couldn't exist. The electron itself must be spontaneously appearing out of the background field. If it was not spontaneously persisting, then we have to invoke the somewhat Neanderthal concept that everything had to start at a certain moment. And because we have embraced this new cosmology of the Big Bang in the last couple of decades, we have some real problems. This is not the best forum to go into this in great detail, but I will say that this universe is clumpy. That's a term that is used frequently in astrophysics to describe the fact that mass is not uniformly or isotropically distributed. It is simply not. On a large-scale basis, with models that have assimilated data from observatories from all over the world, especially over the last few years, we have seen that the universe we observe is indeed clumpy. It is, in fact, concentrated in a way that cannot be the artifact of a Big Bang. Now, that's a bold statement. Alphen, Swiss Nobel laureate, famous for Alphen waves, has come up with an extraordinarily beautiful description of the plasma dynamics of space. And so far, interesting to note, although he was considered to be a complete heretic when he came out with this theory, every single observation we have made from space with satellite probes has confirmed his predictions. I think it very important that everybody here who is interested in the reality in which we adhere become familiar with either the esoteric or the exoteric level of Alphen's work. It is just beginning to appear in the literature. I think Discover magazine had a rather prosaic presentation of it, but it was also quite good. June 1988. Quote, "The Big Bang never happened." If there was not a Big Bang, there were things conveniently began with a single event. Then we need to begin to consider the fact that something that has a gram equivalence about a gram per cubic centimeter, which is our body, must be rather insignificant modification of a field that has a potential of 10 to the 94th power grams per cubic centimeter. Here we are back to that tremendous relative figure. This impacts the way in which we live together. It impacts the way in which we live with the earth itself. I had not initially planned today to show some slides from the NASIC program, but because this is a cap speech at the end of the day, I feel that it might be very useful to digress for a moment and observe the rather catastrophic impact that the very concept of discrete encapsulation has had upon human existence and the earth itself. I would suggest to you, after considerable study of the subject, which is now becoming accepted in the literature worldwide, that we cannot sustain the dynamic of human existence any longer unless we begin to transcend the arbitrary, subjective boundaries that we presume to be true. Whether these boundaries are about ourselves or all phenomena of manifest existence, until we begin to move beyond this anal retentive state in which everything must be particularized, everything being particularized leaves Humpty Dumpty. We will never be able to reassemble existence. You mess it up too much, you've had it. That is our layman's thought. As Fuller pointed out to me at an early age, existence is already implicitly whole. We break it into parts only in our minds only. It is already unified, whether or not we have a unified field theory or not. And as Einstein suggested at his last series of lectures at the Advanced Institute at Princeton, perhaps we can only appreciate the unified field by entering a conscious relation with it. Again, this is something that would not have been at all contrary to what Nikola Tesla proposed. And yet some people would be embarrassed to say it. I think we need to very succinctly consider that we cannot continue to burn fossil fuels on this planet, and that we really haven't found anything to do with our nuclear waste, and that the appearance of bona fide third-party confirmation of the generation of energy from space is a significant event in history. It's not significant because it will make a few men popular or unpopular. It's not significant because it will somehow create a minor change in our concept of being. It's significant because it represents a dramatic shift that we desperately need to embrace. Right now, we're sitting at the edge of an unprecedented human catastrophe on this planet. A friend of mine, Syed Syed, at Texas A&M, who has for 20 years been a climatologist, An elegant experiment recently carried out in Antarctica has shown clearly that if we lose between 6 to 7% more of the remaining stratospheric ozone, the phytoplankton in the ocean will die. There is back on one of these key 7 or 8 shifts in our entire lives. The phytoplankton in our oceans contribute 50% of the oxygen that we enjoy on this planet. It is extremely important to point out that prior to the appearance of photosynthesizing biomass, oxygen was a trace gas that basically appeared through the natural transitions of water, H2O. We simply cannot afford to lose any more oxygen than we already have. At this moment, literally hundreds of millions of internal combustion engines are running. A six-cylinder engine of normal displacement consumes 800,000 cubic centimeters of oxygen per hour. This transforms the breathable oxygen into combustion byproducts, an entire spectrum of combustion products. About four or five years ago, there was an oxygen conference down in San Antonio, Texas. And they were pointing out that way back there may have been over 30% oxygen in our atmosphere. So now it's down approaching 20, and in some cities that are very heavy transportation and roads and solid buildings, heavy cities, it may go down 19, 18, and if it gets down around 16, it's hardly livable, and the people's asthma and everything breaks out. But that's going on. And I gave a paper there that's a half hour and well recorded on rebuilding forests to help stabilize climate, to take out the CO2 and put back in oxygen. So this they wanted, because their whole approach was to say we've got to rebuild the world's oxygen supply and raise that level with the various approaches. All right, we go on. We simply cannot afford to lose any more oxygen than we already have. I read that. In the last 20 years in Africa alone, we have destroyed 64% of the biomass ground cover. He's right saying this in 1988. In the last 20 years, this is a United Nations Environmental Program figure confirmed by satellite and manned space flight telemetry. Also in the last 20 years, we've consumed 29% of the photosynthesizing ground cover in Central and South America. In the last 20 years, you cannot consume oxygen at the same time you consume the factories that metabolize CO2 and return oxygen to us, the forests. And expect to have a sustainable environment, because as oxygen tensions decrease disproportionately, this is because there is a column of oxygen and other gases that rises from the biosphere up to the troposphere and then to the stratosphere where the ozone is. It is on the basis of the mixture of these gases that we have ozone in the atmosphere. I would suggest that we cannot afford to wait demand that serious money is applied to this research, federal money. We need this to happen desperately. We need this to happen immediately. And for those of us who feel that we can be blasé and wait and wait and wait until somehow this becomes acceptable, the implementation of this new kind of technology, let me just say that if we think we can wait, we're sorely deluded. We wonder why there is drought in Ethiopia. We hear in Time magazine that the so-called scientists can't figure out why there is a drought. Well, Ethiopia, beginning of the century, was covered by 43% forest. Ethiopia today is covered by less than 4% forest. How is the hydraulic cycle supposed to maintain itself? This entire consideration at first, seemed to be in rather left field of the consideration of energy generation. But as I began to explore it further and further and lectured around the world, I began to discover that most of the human race has been entirely uninformed. Some people have suggested this is rather conspiratorial. The slides you're going to see in just a minute have been available, some of them for several years. We finally got a few of them on CNN December of 1987, he thinks. I think when you see them, you're going to realize why they're so significant. And I can add, these are on a video and I've seen them myself recently. We even showed them for some people running for governor here in California. To go on. And as always, I would like to thank Richard Underwood of NASA, now retired. He wants to thank him for providing these images. They are in the public domain. But anyone who has tried to get photographic data from the NASA spaceflight program, especially during the Reagan administration, will find that it's a very difficult thing to do. As a matter of fact, most of the infrared photography is now stored at Ames, and you can't get into the building. Even though this material is not classified, the building itself is off limits. I'd like to have the lights dimmed. I'd like to show these slides, and we can go from there. We can discuss in more detail about this and other things. This is the way clouds are supposed to look. So now you think you're watching slides. This is the way clouds are supposed to look over the rainforest. These are healthy clouds. These clouds are appearing over the northern Congo area, and this photograph was taken in the mid-70s from Skylab. Cumulonimbus, stratocumulus, very beautiful cloud formations, and an extraordinary density of water vapor, as you can see. Next slide. This is what the ground looks like after you get rid of the forest. This picture isn't from Africa, it's from Brazil. But literally, millions of hectares worldwide look like this today. You can see the watershed to this river, which is the Sao Paulo River, has been almost totally devastated. You can see that evaporation would occur rather rapidly instead of in a moderate sense through the membrane canopy of the forest. The next slide shows the way clouds look after you do this. By the way, this is the same coordinate, almost exactly, taken from the space shuttle in 1984. As the slides were big, billowy, beautiful clouds in the Skylab 10 years earlier, what you see beneath this cloud bank is now desert. So the cloud building is no longer healthy. Instead of that nice kind of veil of water vapor, you see an extraordinary Los Angeles scale optical density. That's dust. Dust that has been lifted and aerosolized and now remains in chronic suspension over much of the African continent. The clouds are flat. The convective humid currents that rose from the rainforest no longer carry water vapor in significant quantities. There was a great effort, a joint effort of the United Nations and several other countries to seed what clouds remained to see if the hydraulic cycle could be restored. Unfortunately, somebody forgot to plant anything under the seeded clouds. So the desert is now growing. The Sahara Desert is now growing 6 miles per year and is 3,000 miles across. This is significant. Next slide, please. This is to give you an idea of the scale. We are not looking at the desert floor here. We're looking at a pall of dust that stretches as far as the eye can see to the curvature of the earth. 25, maybe 28,000 square miles here. This area all used to be called the sub-Sahara and now is moving into the Sahara, flat clouds, no rain. The next slide will show you conclusively that when you see breaks in the pattern, you have a deeper understanding of the optical density. This density is equivalent to a critical day in Los Angeles. This again is chronic and has serious ramifications for us on this continent. Serious ramifications. This has happened because somebody denied vision. This has happened because when in 1906, Nikola Tesla said that fossil fuels would one day create a corruption in the entire atmosphere of the Earth, he was called an eccentric. Next slide, please. South of the aridification process in Zaire, we have fires. These fires are burning out of control. They have no planes to drop chemicals on the fires. They have no fire departments. They have no money. This is a small area, only 100 by 100 miles. You can see where the forest that was once there has already been stripped away and the hydraulic cycle therefore undermined. The next picture is Angola burning. The CIA did not win the war in Angola. Fire did. 13 million acres burned in 1985. When NASA scientists examined this photograph, they thought that this was some sort of strange cloud until they realized it was the combination of the plumes of smoke from the fires. Just consider the area involved. Consider the fact that this is now being visited on our country. Alaska in the last 3 weeks had lost 750,000 acres to fire. The Secretary of the Interior, Hodel, said, quote, "Let nature take its course." They saved part of Yellowstone, that was close to Old Faithful, but decided that the rest of the wildlife habitat was expendable. And this, while we are spending hundreds of millions of dollars producing neutron bombs and other clean kill weapons, which can never be used, and God forbid they ever should be. The next slide. Here is Yungoy Bay on the coast of Madagascar. It is not uncharacteristic of all bays all over the world now. This is what happens after the deforestation and after the fires. This bay was over 600 feet deep 20 years ago. Now you're going to walk across it during the dry season. It is so filled with silt. This is happening now today. It is not theoretical. We have to move now. Next slide, please. This beautiful lake was called Chad. Lake Chad. It was the size of Lake Erie. Lake Chad supported 1.8 million human beings in peripheral agriculture and fisheries. The next slide is Lake Chad in 1982. It's the hole that was left when the hydrological cycle was destroyed in Africa. I'm telling you, this is hard to read. This is not a cycle, a cyclical drought, and it's not a drought that will only visit it in Africa. The water vapor distribution on this planet is being changed dramatically by the destruction of biomass. The water vapor budget on this planet is being changed dramatically because we have failed to feel beyond our own little subjective event horizons. We tend to exist like psychic black holes. We take a lot and give too little. A few years ago, I pointed out at the 4th International Conference on Atmospheric that the drought of 1986 and 88 would occur. Now they have occurred. They're not going to cease because we don't want them to occur. They're not going to cease until we realize that we need to mobilize every democracy on this planet. And hopefully, that will someday soon include the Soviet Union to implement this new class of technologies. We can address these issues. By planting forests and by using energy generated these new technologies. Whether you call it an N machine or something else, I'm sure these technologies will continue to evolve. Remember, he was talking in 1988. What's that? 12, 13, 14, 15 years ago. By utilizing this energy, we can get directly from the vacuum of space. We can desalinate, re-irrigate. The Israelis, if nothing else, have shown us that you can resurrect the desert. We're going to need to resurrect a planet. We cannot posture ourselves and say that national security comes before the security of the human race. It is the security of the human race in total that is now threatened. This is the last slide. I'm only going to show 11 slides today. I think they speak for themselves. This veil of dust that stretches out towards the horizon across the Atlantic Ocean, reaching from the Caribbean Sea in the lower portion all the way to the African coast. This is not a phenomenon that occurred in 1 year. This is a phenomenon that occurs every year. Between 8 and 9 million square kilometers this year, this dust acts as condensation nuclei for water vapor, causing precipitation in the south. Over water, in Honduras, in Nicaragua, while the Midwest and Southeast are parched. We are changing the way things work, and we haven't even begun to inspect the ramifications. It isn't just the greenhouse effect, it's a much more complex issue. Only by stepping over the threshold into a more synergistic view, which is not just a kind of convenient term bandied about for the sake of the New Age, but only by entering into a more synergistic view which acknowledges the inherent coherence of phenomena, can we begin to comprehend the fact that when you do something here, it affects something over there. In quantum geometric dynamics, actually, in a number of other studies, what we call action at a distance, in a coherent field, distance is not resumed. I hope that this all has said something. Fuller's suggestion was that Project Earth should either determine whether there was a reason why we had to implement these technologies, or whether it was no big deal. Quote, can we last longer? He may have tongue-in-cheek. He says, I need to get my next grant from DuPont to produce more chlorofluorocarbons, knock out the ozone. Yes, it does seem that it might have that effect, but if I say that in the literature, then I am defying my contract. Can't do that. He smiled in the videotape. Scientific integrity, which used to be something that characterized science, is something that is sadly lacking in too much of the scientific society, posturing themselves as authorities, condemning to the inertia of the past and past conceptualizations of reality. Recently, I was lecturing at John Hopkins, which is in itself sort of a miracle, about zero-point physics. And while we were considering zero-point physics, somebody said, well, this is all well and good that Mr. Tiwari did this over in India. It's all well and good that you've done this in the United States, De Palma. It's all well and good to demonstrate. But what about the United States government? Silence. I mean, wouldn't the United States government be doing something? The child asked. A 62-year-old child, a very nice man, actually. And I said, all you need to do is get a hold of the 1986 fiscal year request for proposals published by the Department of Defense. Look on page 193 of that document, and you will see something very interesting. In AF section, which is the Air Force section 86-77, subsection 6, you will see that a government which denies the reality of zero-point technologies is requesting further research into esoteric energies heretofore unknown, including the zero-point dynamic fluctuations of space, end quote. That's in the Air Force section for propulsion. But it doesn't exist, you see. That's quoting Trombley. But we want you to research it if you have bona fide organization that happens to be a prime contractor with triple security clearance. This for propulsion for the Air Force when the entire human race is threatened. Now there's a certain kind of insanity somewhere implicit in that. It's in the literature. You can order a copy from Project Earth or call the Pentagon. This is not a classified document. I won't get in trouble for saying anything. This is actually a program that is ongoing right now, today, within the government enclave. Call Los Alamos and ask a question about it, and you might get a very long silence on the other end. Call Lawrence Livermore Laboratories, their Aberdeen testing grounds. The same phenomenon will probably occur. A significant amount of funding is going to make sure that this irrelevant, mythical phenomenon is applied to weapon systems and weapons carrying systems. Something is very wrong about that. I don't believe that anybody sitting in this room would say that it's in the best interest of our people, or any people of the world, for this kind of technology to be applied outside the realm of civilian application at such a time. Six to 7% further depletion in stratospheric ozone, and we are seeing depletion rate trends that indicate that this level of loss will occur very easily within the next two decades. There is one of the main things he left to the audience. Those of us who have really considered this, and as you consider it more and more, I'm sure, you'll realize that two decades pass very quickly for all of us. It doesn't give us time, as I said before, subjectivity. This field has survived, but not on the basis of being acceptable in the literature. Tiwari has tried to publish. I know the IEEE, the International Electrical and Electronic Engineers, is involved in this conference, but Tiwari tried to publish in the IEEE and was summarily rejected. Many of us have tried to publish and have been rejected. The reason Tiwari even bothered to try to duplicate this acyclic closed magnetic generator after years of correspondence with De Palma was because he was able to convince some mechanical engineers that it had some engineering method. You see, they actually did material stress analysis. We also analyzed, we used beryllium copper for a reason. It's just engineering. There are a lot of you in this room who are perfectly capable of doing it. There's nothing magical. We just operated on a different presumption. We said maybe this experiment will work. If it doesn't work, we'll then, it's like 80% of the rest of it. If it does work, then there's another level of confirmation. Robert Kinchlow, professor emeritus of Stanford University, went to visit, how can we call it, the encumbered sunburst machine. This machine was originally developed by De Palma, Richardson, and Bernard at Sunburst Farm, Santa Barbara, California. Dr. Kinchlow, just out of curiosity of his own mind, decided he would just see if there was something about it that was unusual. He presented a paper on it, and I understand that it only got to Bruce De Palma through somebody else, but that's not unusual. My own attorney directed my attention to an article I never knew existed. It's funny about that. It's funny when representatives from our government look me straight in the eye and say, yes, we know this is real, but we wonder why you would disclose it to foreign nations. I said, quote, I didn't disclose it to foreign nations. It was in an international publication in 1982. And I didn't even know it. Now, this again is an indication of what's going on in all these different forces. I would suggest to you that it's time for us not simply to entertain a curiosity. I would suggest to you that it's time for us to enter a human process of interrelationship, to try to attempt to reintegrate ourselves with one another, and not in a floaty kind of New Age sense, that's in quotes, necessarily at all. Just call 10 people. Ask them to each call 10 people and tell them that if we have an emergency on our hands, demand that the people we are hiring represent us, supposedly, not the major corporations. We are hiring these people to represent us. Big capital letters. Which one of you has the power to lobby in Washington? We need to send a very clear message to Washington states. Gee, don't you think it's silly to be talking about Star Wars? We're only talking about global genocide. This without doing anything except for what we're doing right now. We don't have to drop a bomb or fight a war. Just continue exactly as we are now. All we have to do is remain in this collective state of inertia. And I don't personally believe we're going to do that. I don't believe that human beings are not going to arise to this occasion. I don't believe it for a second, but I do believe we need first to understand what we are confronted with, and then we need to understand that we can do something about it. We need to act, and we need to act like somebody who is being chased by a hot poker or someone who cares. Whichever your response is, act. 10 people calling 10 people calling 10 people covers the country in a week. It's called exponential networking. I didn't come up with the idea, Fuller did. Call 10 people, ask them to call 10 people and find out what happens. It's the equivalence of an electron avalanche in human society. It works. So this is again 1988. So I wanted to try to give a wrap up, and I wanted to cite the fact that we wouldn't be here if it weren't for somebody's vision. Yes, their vision was applied. Their vision, his vision, Nikola Tesla's vision, was brought into life. Otherwise, we have not, he would have been a mere mystic, wouldn't he? Yes, we do have to sit down with our Macintoshes or sit with our Hewlett-Packard 41C calculators. We had a lot of money for this field. A total between the two phases of experiment of about $200,000. And now I'm happy to say it looks like it's going to be produced, or at least this one is going to be produced. It looks like the Palma is also moving into that modality. We're certainly hoping that more people will come out of the woodwork and say, hey, well, I've had this thing for the last 30 years, but I was told if I brought it out into the public when I was working in Los Alamos 20 years ago, they would basically permit character assassination to ensue. And it's hard to believe in some ways, and I don't want to paint a black picture, but I think we have to see the end of times when the New York Times calls a National Center of Atmospheric Research scientist to ask, how come everyone in the world says that Reagan report on acid rain is a lie? And the man answers, you don't understand the kind of pressure we're under, quotes here. People's careers are in jeopardy. This, and then here's Trombley, this when all our lives are at stake. So I'd like to open the floor to questions. And he ends up with, we are talking about a change in the mixture of gases, okay? There are people who say that even if you combusted all the carbon on the earth, biomass, and post-biomass, the oil reserves, everything there would still, there would still 75% of the oxygen in the atmosphere. Unfortunately, they fail to take certain things into account. For example, today we sit. If you knew what we went through to get this acknowledgement and acknowledge the world press, and it would take me an hour to tell you, but we now have it publicly acknowledged by NASA that we have between 2.3% and 6.6% depletion in worldwide atmospheric ozone, depending on latitude and time of year. This not taking into account. When this level of ozone depletion occurs, the level of ultraviolet influx increases the probability of photosynthesis in the lower atmosphere, so the oxygen is preferentially converted into an H2O3, for example. This would normally only appear in great quantities after a lightning storm in the past. We have a lot of this hydrogen H2O3 in the atmosphere. We have a lot of ozone in the troposphere, which until very recently has been attributed to internal combustion. But ozone was appearing in large quantities in rural areas where there was very little internal combustion, relatively speaking. It became an embarrassment when the Department of Agriculture had to admit that $2.6 billion worth of crops were being destroyed per year by ozone alone. So the photosynthetic reaction that is occurring as a result of increased ultraviolet influx must be taken into account if we're going to begin to understand what is going to be sustainable in terms of oxygen tensions. It is the mixture of gases that rise in the biosphere through the troposphere and into the stratosphere that determines the ozone, tension of ozone. The Nimbus satellite, by the way, this is nearing his end. The Nimbus satellite, by the way, which NASA has conveniently said is out of calibration, even though it was in fine calibration last September, in an almost perfect agreement with the instrumentation on the ground in Antarctica, which, by the way, at the center of the Antarctic hole, 6 miles up, we had 96% depletion levels last year. That was 1987. The jumpsuits worn by some of my friends from the Center for Atmospheric Research, please understand, there are a lot of good people there, people I respect a lot. Their nylon jumpsuits were actually degraded by the ultraviolet exposure in just one flight. Several people had serious eye injuries. Now, anybody who's going to suggest that this type of influx is not going to affect the species of molecules that we have in the atmosphere, and the mixture of those gases, is denying an extremely important fact. So, whereas I'm not suggesting we're all going to die of anoxia, lack of oxygen. What's going to happen when the phytoplankton in the oceans die? But what's going to happen when the phytoplankton in the oceans die? They are the basis of the entire oceanic food chain. If you are not familiar with them, they're the little critters that actually make all this possible. The conference would not be occurring today without their sponsorship. I think we need to realize that we are sponsored by living things, and we need to support them so they can support us. Does that answer your question? It occurs to me that the resurrection of Nikola Tesla's vision and other people who have had that vision of the quantum ether may yet be called on for a second offering. I think it's a good time to invest in this second offering of free energy. We did not invest the last time, and now we are paying for it. I don't want to see anybody suffer. What will it be like in 10 years when already the American Cancer Society, that says even with sunscreen protection ratings of 15 SPF, direct sun exposure should be limited to an hour. I hope the Tesla Society will prosper and move into a new age of manufacturing, implementation, and further development. I want what has happened so far to be totally obsolete in 10 years. 1 kilowatt in your pocket, why not? There is absolutely no reason why not. You've got 10 to the 94th power grams per cubic centimeter energy equivalent field. It's not in a great big area, but it's a lot of energy. If we could just scrape the surface ever so slightly, we would never have to worry about it again. That's what Nikola Tesla was scheduled to tell Franklin Delano Roosevelt back in 1943. In 1943, he had proposed to FDR that perhaps we should look carefully at the fact that we can get all the energy we need from any space we happen to be in. He didn't show up for that meeting with the president. He was found dead in his apartment, quote, natural causes. There is some suspicion that maybe his visionary paranoia of poisoning was not exactly paranoia, but premonition. I've never mentioned this before.